Okay.
Oh, man.
Okay, the Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for Wednesday, February 6th will come to order. We have a quorum present. You guys are doing really good getting here on time. I'm really impressed with it. How are you?
Just fine, just fine.
Okay. Snowing again. You know, we got to figure out how to make traffic move better when there's snowstorms down here, don't we?
Yeah, why was it supposed to snow?
Yeah. Oh, it's awful.
Mr. Chair, I'd mention that the freshman senators are well represented here.
Yes, and I'm very impressed with you freshman senators.
We haven't picked up on the illness yet.
You will get it, don't worry. You know, the Senator Osmek, I had a guy say to me when I first got elected, he said, I voted for you. This is 20 years ago. He said, I voted for you. He said, I hope you're not going to be like other politicians. And I said, what's that? He said, you arrive late and leave early. And I didn't exactly know what he meant until I started doing the job. And I understand now when you have six different meetings at the same time and try to make them all. So maybe that's why we have staff, huh? Maybe I should use you guys better. Anyway, we have some overviews again today. I'm not sure when we're going to get into bills. But it's going to happen pretty soon. Scott's kind of taking care of that, and maybe that's where he is today, figuring out where the bills are. But we do have to hear these overviews, and we have to wait till we get the bills from the agencies so we can start acting on bills. And most of what will end up happening, I think, is that all of these bills will end up in an omnibus bill. But I think we should hear each one of them individually just to see what's in each of the bills so everybody's aware of what's going to be in the omnibus bill. There could be a few things in the omnibus bill on top of what we hear from the agencies, and because that's normally how it goes. And because each of you will probably want something in the omnibus bill that we would want to include. And so and so that's a good way to get it passed out of the committee. Anyway, let's start with Explore Minnesota Tourism. And Mr. Edmund, go ahead and give us the overview of your agency.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is John Edmund. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. With me also is Danelle Hilliard from Visit Bemidji, who's going to talk after I talk a little bit about what we're tourism from a local perspective. But what I intend to do here today is to kind of give you a quick overview of Explore Minnesota Tourism for those of you that aren't familiar with our agency, talk a little bit about what we as an organization do. Talk about some of our goals, our agency functions, kind of the customers that we serve. And then I'm going to get into a brief discussion of our budget, the current budget, and the proposed budget that the governor recommended for the next biennium. And then hopefully there's some time for some questions and answers if you have any. But I'd like to begin with your, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, to show you a brief little video. It's a 3-minute video talking about the importance of tourism throughout Minnesota. I've talked to a lot of my colleagues in other states, and when they appear before legislative bodies talking about return on investment and specific dollars, that maybe does not resonate as much as hearing from citizens throughout the state and what tourism means to you. So with your permission, I'd just like to show you this quick little video right now.
You have my permission.
There you go.
I want to come to Minnesota. It's a great state. It's got hills. It's got flatlands. It's got rivers. It's got the Great North Shore. So why wouldn't you want to come to Minnesota?
And I think that's the beauty of tourism. The ability to revitalize Main Street.
20%, one out of every 5 people that come to the Walker are tourists.
There's something about Lake Superior that just draws people. Well,
we do a tremendous number of weddings. We've had weddings from outstate.
Our population doubles. Great Lakes, Alexandria, Otter Tail. Our population doubles within the area for tourism.
Not only do we get visitors from just the upper Midwest and our surrounding states, but I get visitors from all over the world.
With the opening of the global market, there was no question that Lake Street had a tourist attraction.
So they come to Minnesota, they come to the Midtown Global.
to continue that tourism experience that they have in other countries, experience the world in one location.
Without the small businesses, we wouldn't exist, and without tourism, they wouldn't exist.
We know that our hotels and restaurants are critical partners in the relationship with the Walker.
We employ small businesses like electricians, contractors, plumbers.
Whether that's florists or cake decorators or transportation companies.
At the global market, we employ over 200 people.
Tourism has a definite effect on employment at the company. Tourism is a big driver for jobs.
They're spending two, three, four nights in a hotel, many restaurants, shopping, going down to the Mall of America, taking our public transit, of course, traveling through the airport perhaps, or renting a car. All of those things matter a lot to the whole economic engine.
Are there opportunities to increase tourism?
All too often, we're a hidden treasure.
If I can impart any advice for people in tourism, to focus on that authentic experience.
We need to let more people know what we have here.
And I think there's more opportunity to look at those off months, those winter months, and those holiday times to get people up here.
There's a huge market out there around the country. I can't hit that market by myself.
We find that they may have come into the state knowing one or two things about Minnesota, but they leave very pleasantly surprised.
I guarantee you that when they come back.
It's a snowballing kind of effect.
I think the more people that we can expose to Minnesota, the better.
So there's hundreds of stories outside of the Twin Cities, and there's 101 stories inside the Twin Cities of things going on that make it a really wonderful place to visit.
Have a say, easy, hard to leave.
So if there was a way we could get that message out to more people, think what that would do for everyone.
So Senator Saxog, did you see Grand Rapids in that?
I thought I did, but you know, there's a lot of places in this state that you could see 1,000 times.
Because I didn't think I saw the Iron Range either. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, all those destinations were implied. So that's just kind of, Mr. Chairman, members, gives you an idea of why we do what we do. It's for people throughout the states, the businesses, the tourism businesses, the non-tourism businesses, communities all throughout Minnesota. Because we generate jobs, we bring in revenue, we support quality of life, and try to portray Minnesota not as a place to vacation, but also a place to work and to do business as well. Just briefly, some of our goals are to increase the number of travelers to Minnesota. Resident and non-resident travelers is about 71 million. Annual travelers to Minnesota each year, that's more than 13 times the population of the state. And those people come here and they spend a lot of money. They spend a lot of money on receipts. We try to grow tourism sales. In 2011, the tourism industry brought in gross sales of almost $12 billion. And then from 2003 to 2011, leisure and hospitality tax revenue grew 41%. And you just compare that to all other industries, which is growing at about 19%. So this is really an opportunity to bring in revenue for the state and for local communities. We try to generate revenue through sales tax. State sales tax generated is about $769 million annually. Which is interesting to note, it's 17% of all sales tax revenues in Minnesota. The number of jobs in Minnesota, specifically in the leisure and hospitality industry, is about 240,000 jobs with a $4 billion payroll, and that's 11% of all private sector employment.
On those figures, like the 11% and the 17%, are you including like hotels and people who work in hotels and the increased sales tax that is on hotels, are those the things that are increased in those, included in those figures, or how do you make?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, those figures are from the Department of Revenue for those businesses that are classified under leisure and hospitality, and so yes, they do include hotels, restaurants, attractions, and the like. It does not include retail, however, and retail is a big part of what people do when they travel here. But it's specifically those leisure and hospitality NAICS codes.
Okay.
Explore Minnesota Tourism. Now, just for those of you that aren't familiar with us, we're a non-cabinet-level agency. We have relatively small, 60 full-time and part-time staff, 48 FTEs. In addition to our main office here in the metro area, we have offices in Brainerd, Duluth, Thief River Falls, and Mankato. And we also staff travel information centers at locations in the borders, six of them throughout the state. We have three main functions as an organization. The big one, or one of the bigger ones, marketing, PR, and research, and that's where we do all our advertising and our group tour and international. Our operations and our technology unit deals a lot with the database. That's sort of a core of how people get information. Everyone in Minnesota, every attraction and hotel is able to receive a free listing on exploreminnesota.com, and that's really a place where people go, whether it's on mobile sites or websites or our travel counselors use to get information about travel. And that unit also contains our distribution and contact center. And then the other third unit within our organization is our Industry Relations and Travel Information Center unit. Our Industry Relations unit includes our regional offices. We also deal with a small grant program to communities throughout the state, deal with our partnership or affiliate TICs, and we deal with programs dealing with meetings and conventions and sports marketing and the like. Now, one of the things that kind of makes us unique is that we have a tourism council. It's an advisory council that helps guide us in our efforts. It's a 28-person council representing all aspects of the tourism industry, from hotels to resorts to chambers to retail establishments. We have four legislators on the council, two from the Senate and two from the House, one from each body. And again, they provide an advisory role. Just real briefly before I get into some of the budget stuff, our customers, our website visits, that's where we've seen our tremendous growth over the last several years. Over 44%, over 3.6 million visits last year. Travel Information Center contacts, 2.7 million, that's up. More digital inquiries. We're not doing as much direct mail as we used to. People come to our site, but then they still want a brochure, and so they contact us for that. We're seeing our phone inquiries go down. We still have an in-house call center, but people aren't contacting us by phone as much as they used to. And website brochure requests and email newsletters are also showing continual growth.
Is there some way to translate that information into people actually coming here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, we did a study this spring with an independent study with a company called Longwoods to ask, how are we influencing people? Yeah, we're reaching them through TV and through inquiries, but how does that translate into people traveling? Did we actually influence people to take a trip? And through that study, we've been able to show that we received a 8-to-1 return on investment for the dollars that we spent, which is it's a real good return for the money that we put in. So we really try to, yeah, we have those numbers that tell you the raw customers served, but one of the things we really want to get at is, did we influence those people to take a trip that they otherwise would not have taken?
So 44% increase website visits, that actually, you can actually figure out if that has had an effect, or it just tells us that more people are looking at your website?
Well, it does, Mr. Chairman, members, it does a couple of things. It's used into the analysis of the return on investment. We've talked to some of those customers and say, did they find the information that they're looking for, and did it cause them to travel? But the other thing we track, too, besides just the raw numbers, is the number of times that those customers then go to an industry site, whether it's a destination site like a CVB or a specific hotel. And most of the hotels and resorts that we talk to throughout the state consistently show that Explore Minnesota is one of their number one referrals of traffic. So we are kind of the top of the funnel, and then we bring those customers down to the local level to make the buying decisions.
Okay. Okay.
Our advertising, you're probably familiar with our More to Explore campaign. Most of that is done in the spring-summer, with about 20% in the fall and the winter. Our markets right now are in the north central states primarily. We don't have the budget to go much farther beyond that, as well as Canada. We put in a lot into digital marketing. About 60% of our marketing dollars go into digital. We still do some TV and radio. And the majority of our dollars is trying to get people from out of state. I mean, we see a lot from our competitors here in Minnesota. You see a lot from Montana and from Colorado and Wisconsin, et cetera. And we have to stay competitive with them, because a lot of destinations, their main source of traffic is the metro area. But we also have to focus on the non-residents because those people stay longer and they spend more money and you get a greater return on investment on those. So that's why we put the majority of our dollars, 60%, into outstate. The More to Explore campaign, you're probably familiar with Joe Maurer, has been exhibited the last 2 years in Midwest markets.
Not that good a singer.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind my saying so, when we did that, but we asked him to do this for free because we couldn't pay him, and it took a while to get Joe Maurer to agree to it. And then when he finally did it, it was at the end of a season, I was talking to Joe and thanking him on behalf of the state of Minnesota, and then I went and talked to his agent, and I said, did anyone tell Joe he had to sing yet? And he goes, no. He didn't know he had to sing when he did that spot. But the fact that he was bad actually made it good. But we did win some awards for that spot. And earlier, Mr. Chairman, you asked about the return on investment. And this basically, we did a return on investment study just this spring, summer, to find out, are we having any impact? And that's where we were able to determine. We were able to generate $154 million in new spending, which translates into 1,850 jobs and $14.6 million in state and local taxes. So it's been a pretty good investment, but we're constantly trying to improve that and to be more effective in what we do. We also do a lot of partnership marketing. Pedal Minnesota is a unique program promoting biking in Minnesota. We've done with the Department of Health and Department of Natural Resources and some health companies. And we do a lot of other agency and association partnerships as well. I just wanted to very briefly throw a slide in here to talk.
Agency and promotion, such as?
Oh, for instance, we do a partnership with the Minnesota Historical Society. Historical Society does partnerships with XL Energy and with us, and we promote a lot of the historic sites throughout the state. We do some partnerships with the Department of Natural Resources and promoting state parks, promoting legacy weekends.
You guys are communicating. That's good. I like that. All right.
Well, we try to be that sort of focus to deal with others because we don't have the resources, but a lot of them are out there marketing, and we need to figure out ways to do it together. I wanted to just mention the travel trade. We have a very small budget in this area, but that's our international marketing efforts, and we focus on Germany, Norway, Sweden, Netherlands, the UK, and Japan. We're also working with our industry to expand efforts into China and into France as well. Most of what we do there, though, is not advertising. It's more working with the trade media, trying to get them to develop tours and media promotions and the like.
How come we don't go to Italy?
Well, a lot of it's based, Mr. Chairman, on the research, on the potential, and the interest with a lot of our partners. We'd love to be able to do more, but
if you need somebody to translate, I can do that. You know.
All right, Mr. Chair, well, keep that in mind.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and my comment is kind of like for years, or many people thought that tourism isn't quote unquote real business like mining or retailing or manufacturing, and of course, those of us that understand what a good economy is understand that new money coming into your community, whether it's a city or a county or a state, is what makes you cook, because once you get that new money in, then it passes around and around, and that's what tourism does. There's no question about it. And you saw the multiplier effect of what marketing can do. And so I think that any support that we can give, additional support to Explore Minnesota, will be well paid back, and again, that's new money coming in. And my disclaimer is, I'm on Explore Minnesota's board. Thank you.
Senator Duell.
Chair, Senator Saxhog is talking to a couple of House members from his end of the state because they don't seem to share that view about the importance of tourism up there. I agree with you, but yeah. I've been the subject or party or witnessed a number of speeches in which that idea is not as enthusiastically supported. So, I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
Oh,
Go ahead. He's making a pretty good case, I think, for how good tourism is.
I agree. I'm persuaded. I think there's a couple of House members who aren't persuaded, though. So
okay.
I would advise you to go visit with those. And they're from your end of the world. So, just a quick question. I learned earlier today that at one time the kiosks that Explore Minnesota, or the Minnesota, I think it was then the Minnesota Tourism Agency, had in the rest stops and stuff that had brochures and promotional materials and stuff were paid for from the Trunk Highway Fund. I've been looking through the budget books. I assume that's no longer the case. I'm always got my eyeball out for uses of the Trunk Highway Fund. Is that so?
Mr. Chair, uh-huh. Senator, we used to receive $1 million in Trunk Highway Funds to operate uh-huh. the track, but we lost that. And so, therefore, half of our TICs now, our Travel Information Centers, uh-huh. are now operated in partnership with local communities, and then we uh-huh. have the six remaining, and those are all general fund dollars. So there's no Trunk Highway
all
Funds.
Right, thank you.
The deed commissioner was in here earlier and talked about foreign trade offices being set up in like three different countries. And are you working with Deed in regards to that, the trade office? Is there any coordination between you and Deed in regards to these, what you just put up there as far as our communication with foreign countries is concerned?
Mr. Chair, members, we've worked with the trade office, Commissioner Clark, when she was the trade office director, and a number of different missions trying to include tourism into those. We've worked with some of those offices. We're actually talking about the possibility of something with a China representation because we have no representation in China right now. A lot of times when we have representation in other countries, it's through multi-state partnerships. Like, for instance, we work with the eight Great Lakes states, and they then contract with in-country representation in Germany and the UK, and we work with them. But we have a great dialogue with Deed. Deed provides services for Explore Minnesota because we're a small agency. They provide services in terms of HR and some technology assistance as well as some legislative things. So we have a very good relationship with Deed and look for opportunities where they arise.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I heard you say earlier in your presentation that you don't do much marketing into Canada. And visiting Bemidji as much as I have in the past and coming from the northern part of the state, most of the people we saw, for instance, at Lake Itasca Park came from Canada. So I'm kind of wondering if there's an untapped market there that might help our tourism industry.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I apologize if I misspoke and indicated that we don't market to Canada. Canada is a market that we almost consider a domestic market. When I look at our media buys, it's the north central states, and including Canada, Winnipeg, Thunder Bay, those whole ring provinces. We also do a lot with the tour operators and group tour into Canada. We'd love to be able to do more. In fact, if I were to, I'm not sure if they're on that list of overseas countries because we don't consider overseas, but they're our number one international market
okay.
right now.
Thank
so
you.
Canada is really important to us.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Edmonds. I was hoping that you would mention the Two Nation Vacation project that you were so great to work on.
You may want to do that.
Two Nation, Mr. Chair, Senator, Two Nation Vacations is something that we were involved with ourselves, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the provinces in Manitoba and Ontario, to promote cooperation between the two countries, which extended into a tourism program. So that's one of the several international multi-state partnerships, Great Lakes of North America, Mississippi River Country, Two Nation Tours. And, in fact, we're even a partner, believe it or not, with Rocky Mountain International, although we don't have any Rocky Mountains. But they use us as a gateway destination to extend there. So we try to extend our reach as much as possible, and programs like Two Nation Tours is a great way to do that.
I was worried when you started out there that the two nations were North Dakota and South Dakota. Senator Hurd.
So, Chair, I'd just like to suggest something. My in-laws are a little bit more international, and they live in southern states, so their perception of Minnesota is very different. And when they come visit me, they didn't want to go because they see the diversity here, the Asian community here and the Somali community here. So they didn't want to leave, which is a little troubling. I wish they could go home because they're my in-laws. You know, so something to think about to include that expat, especially we have the light rail coming in Central Corridor that in the future are going to come to my district of Senate District 7, where the one and only Hmong village is there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. In fact, this next slide here talks about a project that we're doing with multiple state agencies on coming up with a state brand for Minnesota. And when you think about Minnesota, we talk about it from Explore Minnesota. There's Positively Minnesota, Historical Society, Natural Resources. We all talk about it in different ways. But what is that common narrative? You know, how is a common way of talking about Minnesota? So we're engaged in a project trying to come up with a state brand. And, Senator, one of the things that we've really talked about is embracing the concept of diversity. We have to think about Minnesota as a growing international culture with a lot of opportunities beyond just the lakes and the woods and the waters and try to be able to attract people for business as well as for pleasure. So that was a very excellent point that we've thought about and part of our branding initiative. So you'll be hearing more about that, Senator and Mr. Chair, soon. Mr. Chair, if I could just quickly continue. I wanted to get into some of the budget issues that will soon be facing you as you're dealing with different appropriations bills. To ground you and where we are at today, Explore Minnesota Tourism right now has an $8.3 million budget. That includes a $500,000 supplemental appropriation. We have to generate money from the private sector, and if we generate $1.5 million, we get this extra $500,000. But where our budget ranks right now with other states, we're about 30th in the country. As I mentioned earlier, you see a lot of advertising from other states because most of our competitors, Wisconsin, South Dakota, Illinois, Michigan, Missouri, they're all spending significantly more than we are. We do try to generate money from a private match. We only have to generate 1.5, but we actually last year we generated 5.4 million cash and in kind to extend our reach. And that's where those partnerships come in. We try to look for partnerships with agencies and organizations and others to kind of get more bang for our dollar. Our budget is broken down roughly in this way. The majority of the dollars are spent on marketing and communications, industry relations 10%, partnerships 4%, and you can read the rest. The operations and the technology is a big part of it because, again, as I mentioned earlier, the technology is really key to how we connect both digitally through websites and mobile and other platforms with consumers. Also, it's worth mentioning that currently within our budget, the Minnesota Film and TV Board is a pass-through as a part of our budget. They're appropriated $325,000 in operating budget. They are required to bring in a match, $1 private sector funding for each dollar, $3 state match. I earlier mentioned our ranking in terms of budget, but these are some other rankings here on the slide showing expenditures. Travel expenditures, the money that people spent, employment, and travel-generated taxes. So even though our budget may not be as high, we're getting a fairly good return. Now, without our budget, in addition to not being able to compete with other destinations, the impact is that we just can't reach out to as many destinations as we would like, as we feel that there is potential. We're not able to do much in Chicago, as an example, because it's a very expensive market, and we don't have the dollars to really do more even as close as Sioux Falls. We're unable to expand in markets with potential like Kansas City, St. Louis, and Omaha. And the frequency of our broadcast is just not what we would always like it to be. So when we get to the governor's proposal for the next biennium, briefly, the governor is proposing a $16 million annual operating budget for Explore Minnesota. This is an annual operating budget that also includes a $500,000 incentive funding. This budget also, recommendation also includes funding for the Minnesota Film and TV Board to retain, to remain as a part of Explore Minnesota. It's a pass-through grant of $325,000. And also a recommendation of $12,000 for the Upper Minnesota Film Office, and that was also in our budget, is in our budget in the current year. The governor did also recommend that in order to fund this expanded marketing, he suggests a car rental tax increase from 6.2% to 9.05%. And this is done in order to generate the revenue that's needed in order to cover the increased funding for Explore Minnesota. I would like to point out, however, that the car rental tax is not a dedicated tax. This is not a dedicated program. This will be something that will be included in the discussions in the tax committee and in the tax bill, which I think I heard will be introduced today or soon. So this will be a separate discussion. But the governor put this in his budget because he felt that we needed to have revenue in order to cover the needed investments. So with an expanded budget, the question is, how will this money be used? It's to strengthen our drive markets, the resident and non-resident, expand our partnerships, support increased international, new emerging markets, which you're unable to do, and expand into other niche markets, which are sports marketing, GLBT, ethnics, or meetings and conventions.
Mr. Edmund, just on the rental car rental tax funding, the increase generates a $15 million. I'm trying to look in the budget book here. Is the $15 million dedicated to tourism, or is it a general fund dedication that then is being used in tourism?
Mr. Chairman, that proposed increase in the car rental tax would go into the general fund. The governor believes that it is a little disingenuous to have a dedicated tax like this, and it's up to you and the legislature to determine how the money is spent. But he proposed this as a way to show a balanced budget, that there may need to be revenue to cover this increased expense.
Okay. And just one other, there was, Senator Dibble, go ahead. Is it at that point?
If you had I had a thought about, I just wanted to mention another kind of related subject.
Go ahead.
Subject.
Go do that. Okay.
So there's been some discussion about, two points I want to raise in relationship to this tax. One is there's this thing called the Motor Vehicle Lease Tax, MVLT, which is similar to the Motor Vehicle Sales Tax. And finance guys, if I'm getting this wrong, tell me. Of course, we know the Motor Vehicle Sales Tax is constitutionally dedicated to transportation, and some of us think that the Motor Vehicle Lease Tax should have been kind of swept up in that dedication. That's a different tax. That's like the long-term lease vehicles. It's kind of the sales tax on long-term lease vehicles. It's not this rental tax. It's a different thing. And so there was some running around thinking, oh, my gosh, because we're at some point going to try to get those dollars back to transportation because we think that's what the public supported. For a while, we were running around wondering what tourism was up to. But we figured out that they're doing the right thing. So I just wanted to make that statement.
Yeah, I think at one point in time you were saying Tomasoni was stealing something.
Yeah, Tomasoni's raiding transportation dollars again. But I guess
straight,
he's not, so that's okay. Now, so the other point, Mr. Chair, is there's a car rental tax on a service, a car sharing service called Our Car that would be subject to this that we might think about that kind of messes up their model, and we can bring them forward to explain their business model. It's not the same thing. It's folks in Minnesota who are using a transportation option, an alternative that's available to them. It's not tourism type of short-term rental. And so we might bring forward an exception for that kind of car rental, this Our Car and Zipcar car sharing model of rental.
That'll be a good thing to bring up when we get the bill in front of us.
Great, then. Thanks.
Okay. What I was going to ask you about, Mr. Edmund, is the snowbait program on the film board. Are you intending to pursue that, or do we got to do that on our own here?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator, the governor did not include funding for the snowbait within our budget. It had been included, I think, 2 years ago. But last year or the session before, the legislature made legacy dollars available for film production in Minnesota. But there hasn't been snowbait dollars within our budget for the last couple of years.
Okay. All right. We may want to talk about that, too. Okay. Are you?
All right. Just very quickly to wrap up, again, how the money would be used and for expanding our marketing. And if you go back to the return on investment study that we did, what this would mean, assuming that we were able to be as effective as we were in the past, each $1 million in funding would generate $84 million in traveler spending, 1,000 jobs, $22 million in income, and $8 million in new state and local tax. So just generally in conclusion, tourism in Minnesota, as you can see, supports communities all throughout the state. It's very diverse. New spending brings in jobs and revenue and quality of life and helps us all portray Minnesota as a great place to live, work, and play. And it obviously allows us to compete better with the competition that we are able to do so right now. So, Mr. Chairman, that completes my formal presentation.
We don't have a copy of the slide program in our files here. Do we? Can you get us, I think, just so each member can have a copy and see all those figures and have
certainly
it in front
Mr.
of
Chair.
Us so that we can have it in the book here. So that since it's Bemidji Day, Ms. Hilliard, do you want to make some comments? Or?
Well, thank you, Chair and members. Yes, it is Bemidji Day, so watch for your plaid around the Capitol. We'll be visiting a lot of you senators. Thank you for this opportunity.
Did you see Paul Bunyan in that promotional video in the beginning there?
There was a little, yeah.
Okay.
You know, he is a big icon for the state.
Well, I'm just hoping he was in there. Okay, go
thank
ahead.
You for recognizing that. I thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of convention and visitor bureaus throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm the executive director for Visit Bemidji Convention and Visitor Bureau. I've been there for 3 years, and prior to that, I was up in Lake of the Woods as the director of tourism. So I've been in tourism, as executive director for 7 years, but my family owned a resort. So I grew up in the hospitality industry. So a little background there. I'm also do sit on the Explore Minnesota Council for John. And also I was just the past chair for the Northwest and Central region of our state, which is the Minnesota Heartland Tourism Association, which conducted of 23 counties. So all the way from Lake of the Woods down to Hutchinson. So, and then all the way up I-29 corridor, Grand Forks, Fargo, Thief River. So I really do hear a lot of what other convention and visitor bureaus and tourism offices do and how they rely on our state. What this really truly means for Bemidji is we can utilize some of that funding and that matching funding that the tourism office can get. We can get into broader expanding our markets. Like the video stated, I think it was Lutzen's manager, I heard her say, we can't do this alone. There's a lot of small entities out there, CVBs in the rural community, that really rely on partnership and organizations like the state tourism to partner and spread that dollar. We can get into markets like Canada, and we can get into some of those magazines and co-ops, and we can expand our budget. As we rely on Explore Minnesota's website, that is our number one. Visit Bemidji's number one referral of, and after all my internet, is Explore Minnesota website referrals. And yes, on an individual base, our CVBs, we do track that. How did you hear from us? The internet. You're in the state guide. I just had a phone call the other day. You're in the state guide. Yes, we are. Again, another opportunity why we need to expand our dollars and our smaller budgets and our CVBs. There's a lot of rural communities that don't have a lot of money to market their town or their area, and they're really capable of doing that by partnering with Explore Minnesota.
Thank you. Any questions of either of the witnesses? Senator Weber.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Edmund, just a quick question. You commented a couple of times about our competition with other areas, obviously for tourism, that type of thing. And I know it's rather early in the process, but has there been any discussion within the department as to what the effect of additional sales taxes on certain elements that lure tourists to Minnesota might, what it might do to tourism or what negatives it may have on tourism?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we haven't had through our industry any formal discussions, just informally within our office and looking at the governor's proposal. One of the things that my research staff noted is that the governor's proposal to reduce the state sales tax to 5.5% actually positively impacts many leisure and recreation businesses. As an example, when a guest comes to Minnesota from anywhere, in-state or out-of-state, and stays at a hotel, they're currently subjected, in addition to a variety of local taxes, a state sales tax. So that would actually lower the tax that someone would pay, you know, on a hotel or whether it's on some kind of a recreational services. As far as the proposed tax on clothing, the governor's proposal would still allow people to purchase things that are under $100. Many travelers come here, and they spend money on clothing. That's a big part of our industry, but they also spend money on other things as well. So we, Mr. Chair and Senator, I don't have a definitive answer. We have not done an analysis, but we say that there's as much good out of that as there is areas for concern.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hilliard, you recently Bemidji invested and the state invested in the Sanford Center, and it's a great facility, and we're seeing a lot of other cities interested, in particular the convention business, to ask for investment, too. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's worked out?
Ms. Hilliard.
Well, I can thank you for mentioning that, Senator. The Sanford Center was just built and opened October 15th of 2010. And with that opportunity in our Bemidji area, that has brought us to advertise, again, additional marketing opportunity for Visit Bemidji, but then to decrease where leisure travel, where do you take that from? And we are now being able to host an event over 350 attendees, so up to 1,000. And that is also something that we are able, as Visit Bemidji, to grow our staff, and we are able to increase a job position and hire a sales director just indirectly that. So I have somebody now representing Bemidji and selling it as a meeting destination. We rely, honestly, I truly rely on the state organization of Meet Minnesota, and they co-op the opportunity for the other CVBs in the state to work together as a team effort and lure that money down so we can actually advertise and we can go to markets and shows and introduce our Sanford Centers or the River Centers, such as that. It's been a great opportunity, but there's always some growing pains in budgets, and when we can partner with our state in the Meet Minnesota partnership and get that money down, we're able to partner with them and advertise that.
Thank you, Senator. Sir, any other questions? Okay, thank you very
much. I got one more. Ms. Hilliard, how's the walleye fishing up on Lake of the Woods this winter? Have you been up?
Yes, I have. Thank you, Senator. We go back and forth on this. You know, I am a hook and bullet kind of gal, too, so what can I say? I love my fishing, and I haven't pulled anything bigger than, you know, about, you know, 24 inches. A couple years ago, it was a 23-inch northern, so I appreciate that. Yeah, it's going good. Tourism is strong up there, too.
Yeah.
So the fishing is good, or is it?
Well, you got to come and see, Sharon.
Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Who's next here? The Bureau of Mediation Services.
Oh, really?
It's been good, but.
Uh,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Josh Tilson, the Commissioner of the Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I have a short prepared statement. I thought the way I'd approach this is to talk to you a little bit about, give you an overview of the BMS, and then a brief overview of the BMS budget recommendation by the governor, and then try to answer any questions that you might have about what we do over
there. Sounds like a plan.
Thank you. The Bureau of Mediation Services, BMS, is responsible for administering the Minnesota labor laws. That's our main brief. There are two main statutes that we administer, 179 and 179A. 179 is a private sector labor relations law, and 179A is the public sector labor law. Most of our business is in the public sector, primarily because of the way the jurisdiction breaks out with the federal government. The agency regulates labor management relations between Minnesota's 1,700-plus public employers, their employees, and exclusive representatives. The BMS was created in 1939 to administer the newly adopted Minnesota Labor Relations Act. This covered only private sector employees, with the exception of some healthcare facilities that were run by local communities and not covered under the National Labor Relations Act. The Minnesota Public Employment Labor Relations Act wasn't adopted until 1971, and prior to that time, there was really no public sector bargaining in Minnesota to speak of. It didn't have a place in the law. There were some local units of governments that did bargain, but didn't have much of a place in state law. Today, the mission of the Bureau of Mediation Services is to promote stable and constructive labor management relations and the use of alternative dispute resolution in public policy disputes other than labor management. So the first thing I want to tell you, and I've had a chance to talk to a number of you privately, but not everybody, and so you should know, and hopefully you do already, but BMS is the smallest cabinet-level agency in state government. There's nobody that's going to come sit in front of you and call themselves a commissioner who has fewer employees or a smaller budget than we have. Fiscal year 2002, our budget was 0.02. The BMS budget was $4.4 million, and in the most recent biennium, the one that's coming to an end now, our budget is $3.1 million, a reduction of about 30%. The result of these cuts was that staff has been reduced significantly. Today we have 11 FTEs, including support personnel and some technology. In spite of our small size, however, we have an outsized impact on government services, primarily due to the broad scope of our jurisdiction. Collective bargaining has a significant impact on public entities. I pass out a little flyer here, and if you look at the side with the pictures on it, it talks about and describes all of the different jurisdictions we have. We basically work with every single unit of state and local government, including the hospitals and nursing homes, the state executive branch, the state court system, all 340 K-12 schools, special boards and commissions, all 1,200 cities and towns, the counties, the University of Minnesota, the 31 campuses of MNSCU. In addition, we do some work in the private sector. So this is why it has a significant impact on the bottom line for local budgets as well as the state budget. As you're well aware, compensation is a huge factor in local and state budgets, and our mediators work with all these people. If you talk to any of your constituents who are involved in administration in public sector in particular, but also in healthcare, they will know our mediators because they work with all of them. At this time, we actually have 7 mediators at the Bureau of Mediation Services covering this entire jurisdiction.
How many have you had in the past?
Well, we had 13 in 2002. When I started, I've been with the Bureau since 1988. I started as a mediator and hearing officer in 1988. When I started, we had 21. So we've shrunk, you know, significantly over the years. But most recently, in particular, we lost this big 30% chunk just in the last 10 years.
And you need them back?
Yeah, we do. I'll talk about that in a second. But our ability to reach out has been diminished. In addition, a factor that is a big deal is that we really have to go out into the local jurisdictions to conduct these mediation sessions. We can't do them remotely. We have to do them physically. So the mediators that work for the Bureau of Mediation Services travel from one end of the state and one side of the state to the other to cover all these mediations. And it's just, it's not physically possible to do all the cases that we're called upon in reasonable periods of time, which means we're pretty much working with a backlog all the time. So in doing this work, BMS has a number of programs. I'd like to just describe them to you real quickly and then talk to you for a minute about the budget recommendation. Labor mediation itself is our main function. And this is the process of going out and sitting with the parties when they can't reach a collective bargaining agreement and trying to help them settle their dispute. Mediator is a neutral, disinterested person who does not have authority to require settlements, but who can merely try to persuade the parties through the use of conflict resolution techniques and persuasion and whatever else they can come up with to try to help them get the parties get their contract resolved. We do about 1,200 mediations a year. In addition to contract mediation, we do grievance mediation, which are disputes over existing agreements, application and adherence to terms of existing agreements. The parties can get help with those kinds of disputes as well. The second major thing we do is called representation, which is the process of determining if employees want to be represented by a particular union or not, and which jobs will be grouped together for purposes of representation. This is much more time-consuming than mediation because it involves administrative hearings, written decisions, frequent appeals to the State Court of Appeals. So we have four kinds of things we do there, which are new certifications, where the union is seeking to organize a new group of employees, decertifications, where employees are seeking to become non-union through a voting process, clarification proceedings, which is where the employees will figure out if there's new classifications or changed classifications, which bargaining units they go in, and we do challenges, which is where one union is challenging another union for its right to represent an existing bargaining unit. We do about, as I said, about 200 of those cases a year, and about 70 of those result in about 70 elections every year. The next program I want to talk about is labor management cooperation. It has shrunk significantly, but labor management cooperative programs are a modern technique of using organizational development skills to get the union and the management to work together on non-wage and terms and conditions of employment issues to try to resolve questions of workplace productivity. They're used for public safety stuff, or we use them in healthcare a lot in trying to find ways to save money in healthcare groups. The state has a big healthcare, worksite healthcare labor management committee that helps manage the state's healthcare plan, the CGIP program. Those are writ large throughout the state and local units of government everywhere. We have about 400 worksite committees. In addition to that, we have a small grant program which has been funded for about $68,000 that supports industry and area councils in the Twin Cities, in Duluth, in the Mississippi River Valley, and a construction committee here in the Twin Cities. Those are the main ones that we're supporting today. Lastly, in the labor relations area, we manage an arbitration roster. The arbitration is a neutral, disinterested person who is the decision maker. If they can't reach an agreement, either on their contract or upon a grievance, they can petition the Bureau to send a list of mediators. Mediators are neutral persons who are not employed by the state. They are private, but we're responsible for qualifying the arbitrators, up to 60 of them. We have a roster right now of about 45. Last year, BMS issued over 1,400. We do about 1,400 to 1,500 lists a year. But most of those get settled by our mediators. We don't do 1,400 or 1,500 arbitrations a year. We do about 150 arbitrations a year. That's kind of what we get paid to do. It's one of the biggest savings that we think we have in the state is because of the cost of arbitrations is significant to the jurisdictions, and the avoidance of litigation and arbitration through grievance mediation and contract mediation is significant. Another area we were doing a lot of is training and technical support, but we've had to reduce that due to our shrunken budget. We do a few trainings a year, but we think that training is something we'd like to beef up because we don't anticipate being able to have enough mediators at any time in the foreseeable future to deal with all the labor disputes in Minnesota. And training labor and management in solving their own disputes in negotiation and conflict resolution techniques is a cost-effective way of avoiding the need for the use of a professional mediator. Finally, the last thing that's in our mission statement I want to talk about for a moment is the promotion of alternative dispute resolution outside labor management. Formerly, the Bureau of Mediation Services had a program called the Office of Dispute Resolution. And the Office of Dispute Resolution did a couple different kinds of things that known generally under the ambit of public policy mediation. I mean, they were mostly such things as disputes between either between citizens and government or between units of government over municipal boundaries, rate setting at waste plants, siting of off-ramps on freeways, airport runway siting. We had some involvement in some environmental disputes. Today we work with the Society for the Blind significantly and do some mediations in that. We used to do special ed mediation. We don't do that anymore. That's been moved over to the Department of Education. But in addition to that, we do have done some mediations for the Department of Human Rights today. They're doing their own as well. But the reason I'm bringing it up and I want to highlight it is that there's a bill that's going to be introduced here sometime in the next, hopefully, the next couple of weeks. And I've been sitting on a committee with a group of people who is going to be proposing a bill to restart the Office of Dispute Resolution and get the state a little bit more involved in doing direct public policy and also funding through a grant mechanism, civil mediation in the communities. The state has a large network of civil mediation agencies, groups that are community groups that are funded at a very small level right now through a grant program, through the judiciary, and they're looking to get more of that work done. So let me just talk for a minute about the governor's budget. Then I'll let you ask whatever questions you have.
And
the
governor, members, just so you're aware, these budgets are all in our budget books here. And there's a tab in the budget books that indicates where it is. So if you want to follow along, you can.
Yeah, and I'll talk about that now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, let me just start out by saying that the Bureau of Mediation Services budget for the most recent biennium was roughly $3.1 million, and that paid for all these things that we did and didn't do. The governor's recommendation actually has two change items that are in our current budget. One would add, you asked the question, Mr. Chairman, one of the recommendations would add two mediators beginning in FY14 for a total biennial cost of $382,000. That we expect that this investment will enable the Bureau to undertake up to 300 more cases a year of direct labor mediation. The savings to the state and local governments in prevented labor disputes will be at least, as I said earlier, 25,000. Maybe I didn't say this earlier, but we think that the minimum cost to local units of government in the state for arbitrations is $25,000. The cost of strikes is about $4.5 million each. Now, we haven't had any strikes in Minnesota, any public sector strikes, since 2008. And I'm happy to take credit for that, but I can also give credit to the poor economy, because people haven't been striking both because we do a good job mediating and because they're really afraid to strike and lose their jobs. And so the tool of a strike has been diminished by the poor economy, and we haven't had any public sector strikes since 2008. These new resources will also enable BMS to speed up the processing of representation cases. You may get complaints from your constituents, employers, and unions about how slow we have been to process representation cases. These quasi-judicial proceedings we do on representation are time-consuming and they're labor-intensive, and we don't have enough staff to produce them, and we're taking too long to get the cases out, sometimes as much as 180 days. It's the biggest complaint I get from my clients. And it's one of the reasons I asked the governor for the additional funding to staff the Bureau. The second item that's in a change item is the governor's put in is to replace the BMS's database and document management system. Our current document management system is over 10 years old. It's no longer supported and needs to be replaced. It's used to create and track our case information, schedule our staff. Create and manage case documents, store and archive, and make available to the public decisions of BMS and labor arbitrators. The governor's budget recommendation includes a one-time appropriation of $100,000 for this project and a base increase of $25,000 beginning in 2015 for the cost of licensing and support. So the governor's recommendation is basically to change the BMS's current biennial appropriation from about 3.1 1 to about 3.8 million, excuse me, $3.65 billion, million dollars. So that's my main presentation. I have some other numbers if you're interested, but maybe I'll just ask if the committee has any questions.
In the budget book, it says $448,000 is the net all change items.
You know, I think that that is the carry forward into FY16-17. For this biennium, the cost to the budget it will be 300 and let me take a look at the book here. It will be 300 and for this biennium, the cost will be 36.50, and going forward, maybe I've got a.
I think we got 482.
Yes, you're right. You're right. It's 482. My mistake. Okay. I picked up an old budget sheet. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for the report on my county tenure of many years. What has evolved is the, especially in rural Minnesota, I think metro counties have been certainly not ahead of the curve necessarily, but have for some time being hiring county coordinators and county administrators to sometimes handle negotiations with union contracts within the counties. And can you give me a little flavor as to whether that's done some good? I know there's some counties that are now quite small counties actually that are hiring administrators, and I know county commissioners come and go like senators, and some can be very reasonable to deal with, some not. So I certainly understand the reasonableness of the process of having a mediator there. I've been involved in mediation before, and can you give me a little idea as to whether the administrators are basically helping out at all in some of these areas, or are they not doing that? And I've got a couple follow-up questions, Mr. Chair, if I could, just a decertifying question, certifying versus certifying, how many of those, and get a flavor for Minnesota. Are unions growing or are they reducing in size? And when you do private work, do you get reimbursement? Or if you do county work, for that matter, does the county board reimburse you for mediation services? That was a lot of questions. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Can you remember,
Mr. Chairman? Senator, I'll try to take them one at a time. First of all, about county administrators. Yeah, you've sort of hit it. I mean, there's a wide range of the way this is handled. Some counties have their county administrator do it. Some counties have the board itself do it. This is true also, by the way, for municipalities. Some municipalities bargain their own contracts, and some counties bargain their own contracts directly using members of the board or the city council. That's very common. Many others have full-time either human resources and labor relations representatives or other staff that are experienced in bargaining and bargain their contracts. In some counties, for example, we see the sheriff bargaining the contract for the sheriffs and the county board bargaining the rest of them. And they work together to try to get those contracts done. Many counties also hire professional labor relations representatives, such as attorneys or other professional consultants. So your question was, is it helping or hindering? I think there's really no way to answer that because it's strictly a case-by-case basis. There are some counties that I wish would hire an administrator because I don't think the board really has time in some of these counties to really put in the serious time that it takes. One of the problems with mediation and contract negotiations is terribly time-consuming. And for the most part, elected officials have full-time jobs, as you know, especially county commissioners, and it's hard for them to sit up, you know, come in after work at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and sit up all night bargaining. And so in other counties, it works out very, very well. So it's there's really no writ large way to put that. Now, Mr. Chairman, Senator, with respect to your second question, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the private sector, you said you do some mediations, Mr. Chair. Mediation services for them. Do you charge that back to them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we do not. This has been proposed a couple times in the past. About our private sector, it's a pretty small chunk of work. Yeah. And the reason it's a pretty small chunk of work is that the federal government has jurisdiction in most of the private sector. And the only places where we do this is where the federal government is unable to provide a mediator or where they lack jurisdiction in a few cases. For example, in agriculture, certain kinds of agriculture that the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction, and in gambling, certain kinds of gambling institutions, the federal government doesn't have, for example, the racetrack, that sort of thing. And there are a few, very few, small number of places where they use us because they've gotten in trouble with their mediator, with the feds, and they've asked us to do it. We have proposed charging for some of these before, and it's been rejected primarily because most people feel that the public savings from the mediations is sort of outweighs the value of getting the resistance to using mediation through charging. They started charging for mediation in Wisconsin, and their mediation load went way down, and their labor and the length and the cost of their labor decisions went way up. So this was before the most recent events. This was going back now 10 years. But this has been brought up several times over the many years. And same in public sector, that charging for in public sector has been rejected by the legislature in the past when it was suggested because it's seen as cost shifting. Particularly with respect to representation stuff, the employer is obligated to bargain with the union and obligated to show up at mediation. And if we charge the public employer for mediation, we're just shifting the cost from the state to the local units of government. Finally, on this question about certifications versus decertifications, we have we're doing about 70 elections a year. About half of those are new certifications. About a quarter are decertifications, and about another quarter are what we call challenge elections, where employees are switching from one union to another. That's ballpark. I can get you firmer numbers on it, but I'd say that'd be pretty close.
Thank you,
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to thank Commissioner Selson for mentioning this discussion that's been going on around reestablishing the Office of Dispute Resolution. I've been a part of that conversation. I'm not carrying the bill myself. I think Senator Johnson is going to be dropping in that bill pretty soon. It's a good idea, and Commissioner Tilson has been cooperative in that conversation. I can attest personally to the value of these kind of community level civic and other kinds of mediation services that are provided, the level of anxiety and drama and expense that are avoided when good mediation services are available, either the small scale neighbor to neighbor or some of these larger scale issues, is pretty dramatic. So at some point I'm guessing we'll see Senator Johnson in the committee.
If I'm not mistaken, Senator Johnson was doing some mediation with her husband Richard after they got out of the House of Representatives, weren't they doing? I don't know if you know about that, but I don't know if it was labor. I don't know if it was labor mediation. I think it might have been something else.
Mr. Not mediating between each other.
Well, that happens.
Yeah, no, I think Senator Johnson has been a community mediator.
That happens on a daily basis. Yeah. That other kind of mediation. So. Any other questions of Mr. Tilson? Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work, and hopefully we can get you some more people.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, Judge Patricia Millen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please say your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Patricia Millen. I am the Chief Judge of the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. I have also sitting at my right Judge Gary Hall. He has recently been appointed to my court.
Congratulations. Are you making more money now or?
Just slightly.
Just okay, all right, good. That's a good thing then. All right.
I did send up a sheet, and I'd like to go through first what our court is. Fundamentally, we consist of five judges who have exclusive
statewide. Your Honor, can you pull the microphone a little bit closer to you?
Our court consists of five judges who have exclusive statewide authority to review workers' compensation cases decided by the Office of Administrative Hearings and on certain occasions by the Department of Labor and Industry. The five judges are appointed as set forth in Statute 176.175A. We also have five staff attorneys, and that is also part of the statute in 175A. Sorry. We have two full-time and two part-time support staff. I think it's important to note that the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals receives 100% of its funding through the Special Compensation Fund. 95% of our budget is rent and salaries. And I believe that's broken down at 87% salaries and 8% rent. I'd also like to point out that our base budget has not changed since 2009. But I am coming forward today to seek a one-time appropriation in the fiscal year 2014. And I am doing so for two reasons. Like most agencies, we are moving towards the cloud and are moving towards technology. The lower court has procured funds for a case management system that is paperless. I need to interface with the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I believe they are moving full speed ahead and will have completed that program within the next fiscal year. Since our court crosses over and our appeals are heard by the Minnesota Supreme Court, I will also be required to interface with the technologies of a paperless system into the judicial branch. And again, my budget that I am seeking an increase in will be able to interface and accommodate that challenge. And finally, I am looking at e-filing and e-service myself. We don't have the capabilities or the funding yet to do so. So, Mr. Chairman and members, I am seeking an additional one-time appropriation of $110,000. I am also seeking another $100,000 to pay for the retirement payoffs that aren't part of our payroll. We had an anticipated retirement this week, which will cost me $63,000. We had two unanticipated retirements in the last 12 months, which were over $40,000. 50% of my court is eligible for retirement within the next fiscal year. If I anticipate two retirements, I believe a reasonable but conservative estimate of the $100,000 for one-time appropriation would cover that retirement payout.
Are these judges that are retiring, are they becoming consultants, or are they going back into the law field?
I am unsure where they're heading, but it also covers support staff. We have five staff attorneys. A number of them have been there since the inception of the court, which is 1981. I have two full-time employees under a collective bargaining agreement. They have been there quite a long time as well and are eligible for retirement.
Are the people that are eligible indicating that they are going to retire?
Mr. Chairman, there have been two people that have come forward and started to look into and participate in some of the retirement seminars and programs.
And do you feel like you're adequately staffed, or do you need more people?
We are down to bare bones. I do have in my budget, if you look at the full-time salary, the carryover for two part-time positions that I have left open. We are, again, looking at making one of our part-time employees full-time to be able to carry out the mandates of the statute for the 90-day decisions and to continue to operate with the technology changes.
Would you like to make any comments?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have anything to add. Thank you.
Well, can you tell your boss what a good job she's doing or something like that? I mean,
for the record, she's an excellent chief judge.
Okay, any questions, anybody from here? Okay, this will be an easy one then. And so you have all you're doing is asking for $210,000 total extra from the last biennium to this next biennium.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Any comments, questions? Senator Dietzick, did you have any experience with the workers? You didn't have any experience when you were in the county with them? No? Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming in and being part of the committee. we'll be discussing this probably one more time when we get the budget bill in front of us with the actual language. And I don't know if you heard me earlier, but it will most likely end up in what will be the omnibus bill for the committee, and it'll be your whatever your funding source will be. And I imagine you'll have the same type of hearing in the House. So. Okay.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to meet all of you.
Thank you very much. I heard you were nervous, but you did a nice job if you were. So we're not mean either. Yeah. I would be more worried about going in front of a judge than coming in front of us. Well, that means you're guilty of something, if you're, or somebody's perceiving you as being guilty of something. Mr. Price, Senator Price.
Certainly not speaking from experience.
Certainly not speaking from experience, no. In fact, I think the only time I was in court is when my kid was there. So,
Boy, we've all got those stories.
Uh-huh. Yes. I can still call you Senator. Senator Bach tells me that the name, the title Senator never goes away.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Unless you have a higher title now, maybe Executive Director sounds more important than Senator.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, Len works fine.
Okay.
So, but it is good to be back here. I spent a lot of time in this room in my 12 years in the Senate and was fortunate enough to chair this division once upon a time. And I look around the table, though, and I see an awful lot of new faces. But that's why we're here, is to try to explain what we do and give you some insights about our budget.
It's one of the prime reasons we don't need term limits.
Well, there are term limits. They're called elections.
That's exactly right.
But I have to say, too, that one of the things that I miss the most about being in the legislature is the people that are the staff here. They're just absolutely wonderful, and I appreciate the help that they gave me when I was in the chairmanship, but also the help that they give people who are like us trying to figure out how to get through the process and understand the parameters of statutory and rules. And I really mean that, so thank you.
See,
this is
Senator Price knows who puts the numbers in the bills and stuff, so you're sucking up now, see.
That Italian wine will be forthcoming. This is a pleasure to appear here on behalf of the Conservation Corps of Minnesota. I've been privileged to be the executive director now for 8 years. I'm in my ninth year. We've been a nonprofit 501c3 since 2003. We're not the only people celebrating an anniversary this year, our 10th year of existence. The Civilian Conservation Corps, which was established by President Franklin Roosevelt, will celebrate its 80th anniversary this year. It was at the end of March that he signed the proclamation and the legislation to create essentially a jobs program, employing literally hundreds of thousands of unemployed individuals. We had a CCC-er on our board of directors. He's still kind of an emeritus member. And I've appeared with him a lot of times on panels to talk to young people about what this national service kind of entity means. And I remember him saying it didn't matter who you knew, it didn't matter how strong you were, it didn't matter how smart you were. There were no jobs in the 1930s at the depth of the Depression. And he said when the CCC came along, what it gave us was one thing, hope. It gave us a job. It gave us the dignity that comes with a job. It gave us $30 a month to spend to help support our families. The CCCers got to keep $5. The other 25 went home and obviously saved many businesses and farms and helped families stay together. So we're trying to carry on the spirit of the work that they did in the outdoors with natural resources. We're also trying to continue the spirit of community service. Obviously, there's an unemployment issue with young people that we deal with. If you take the segments of the economy that have unemployment, 18 to 25-year-olds probably are at around the 20 to 25% rate of unemployment. And we take those folks and try to give them training. We do give them training, and we engage them in the kind of work that we are able to do. So this is a big deal, and I think Senator Sieben will carry a resolution commemorating the 80th anniversary of the CCC.
Well, and that's, yeah, that's interesting because those people are now in, if they're still around, they're in their 90s, most of them. And I know there's a few of them that live in Chisholm. There was a big CCC up north of Chisholm at Side Lake where quite a few people worked in. And they talked very affectionately about it and how it did exactly what you said, that it saved their families and allowed them to
Mr. live. Chairman, and many of them did eventually go into the military and serve mm-hmm. in World War II, and there's a whole host of good things that have been said about what the CCC training did in preparation for that. And in your, I think it's in your district, Chisholm,
mm-hmm.
There is a place at the what I always called Iron World, mm-hmm. which has a special building that was created to honor and to commemorate the Civilian Conservation Corps. If any of you get an opportunity to go there, it's absolutely wonderful. And I believe that the administrative headquarters there are the official Minnesota repository for all the records, all the memorabilia and so on that are contributed about the CCC. And it is a part of the historical society, I believe.
That's very impressive for a St. Paul guy to know that kind of stuff. You know?
Well, I've learned a lot about the CCC because one of our board members is an author. She wrote the book Hard Work and a Good Deal, The History of the Conservation Corps in Minnesota. Her name is Barb Summers. Excellent, excellent, highly recommended book. Not trying to front for her books, but it talks about all the different things that the Civilian Conservation Corps did in Minnesota. They just weren't a tree army. They did a whole host of other things. And they're based on oral histories, which a group of people did with Minnesota Civilian Conservation Corps members. It's very impressive. If you get a chance, it's available at the Minnesota Historical Society. But we should get to the point here, I guess.
Yes.
We are pleased that we have partnerships to engage our young people in the kind of work that we do. In 2011, about the same number, 120 different partners. They range from state agencies to federal entities to other nonprofits to soil water conservation districts. Our modus operandi is to operate on public lands. We do work on private lands if those private lands are part of a national or federal or state grant. So, for example, and some of those folks that are from the Lake Country are not here, but let's say that you had a property in Brainerd on a lake and you wanted your shore restored and replanted with native plants. We could do that work if you have been a recipient of a grant from the Soil Water Conservation District, the county, or whomever. We don't want to be a competitor to private enterprise. We are a job, skill, and youth development organization. We're not in business to usurp union positions with state agencies or federal agencies. Our mission is to try to give young people an opportunity to learn job skills and to get experience in these outdoor activities and also to get them outdoors. What I'd like to do is go through the thing that we provided, the report to the state legislature. It's a document that I submitted to you. It's required by legislation that we report each year to the committees. That's this committee and the House Environment Finance across the street, and also to the Department of Natural Resources about how we spend the two major sources of state funding that comes our way. And that's what this report does. So if I could just kind of quickly highlight a few things in the report, and I'll make reference to the page number to try to make this a little bit easier. If you look at page 2, in the last paragraph, it says, in 2012, more than 500 youth and young adults enrolled in conservation programs. Some of these programs are what we call a year-round program, which means for us 10 and a half months roughly from the 1st of February to the middle of December. We don't put young people out in the cold in the woods. It's not prudent. It's sometimes dangerous. And not only do people break down, but so does equipment. So we've learned to scale back. During the really cold and winter parts of the year is when we do a lot of our training.
And was that 500 more or less than you had done in the past?
There is a progression where we've grown. And when I became executive director in 2005, I think we had about maybe 120 total core members. We call them core members. And this year, in 2013, we're anticipating fielding somewhere between 550 and 570 core members. We're pending on a potential grant from the U.S. Forest Service to do work up in Superior National Forest. It's tremendous, our growth, but it hardly makes a dent in the demand. Every application that comes in for one of these 18 to 25-year-old openings, which are the February through December, middle of December, it used to be that we'd get maybe one to one. Now it's probably three to four applicants per position, which is a reflection of the economy. For our youth program, the 15 to 18-year-olds, it's not uncommon for us to get four and five applicants per position. And we typically have had 85 to 90 spots in our summer program. This year, we'll be able to field 120 of these youngsters. We started taking applications last week, and we got far more applications than we have positions available. Again, a function of the interest in the program, but also for them, the opportunity to have a job.
And how much do you pay these people?
Well, it varies. The AmeriCorps connection that we have for 18 to 25-year-olds, the federal government, through the Corporation for National and Community Service, dictates the stipend that they receive. It's about $1,150 a month, which puts them in the category of the working poor, a little over $13,000 a year. They're responsible for their own housing, transportation, and food. For the youngsters in our program that are high school kids, if they're in the summer program, at the end of 4 weeks, they probably go home with $600. My oldest grandson was in the program 2 years ago, and he still stands up a little straighter and sticks his chest out and says, yeah, you know, Grandpa, when I was working in the Corps, that was his first job. Real self-esteem for him. He didn't come back a second year because he found a better job with the farmer down the road. The kids that work after school and on Saturdays in St. Paul in what we call the Youth Outdoors Program, they make minimum wage. St. Paul says these youngsters are going to make minimum wage. To be eligible, you have to be economically disadvantaged. That means you have to be at 80% poverty. So a lot of those youngsters have come from Senator Herr's district. I shared the names of the folks that were in there. And I asked these youngsters, so what do you do with your paycheck? What do you do with your money? Thinking, oh, they're going to go buy electronics, or what are they going to do? And many of them have said, well, we need to share the money with our family because they don't have money. Or the one boy told me, he said, I send a portion of my pay to my grandmother in Laos because we're hoping to get her here in a couple of years. I mean, it's all over the map, but that gives you a sense of how this works. These are volunteers. We don't call them employees because of the nature of the relationship that we have, the rules and regulations that AmeriCorps has in existence. The other thing that happens as long as we're talking about reimbursement, that happens with the 18 to 25-year-old group, they're eligible for what's called an AmeriCorps Education Award. So if they work for a certain length of time, at the end of their service, they receive a voucher, a certificate that says, okay, Len Price, you served a full term of service. You now get the equivalent of a Pell Grant, $5,300 and a voucher. You can take that to any college or university in the United States and go back to school. If you are a college grad, and we do get a lot of them, you can go to your financial institution that you borrowed from, and you can pay down your debt. Can't go out and buy a new car, new computer, can't take a vacation, but you can use it for retraining or paying retraining back. So those are the kind of things that are elements of the economic part of the benefits for the young people that are involved. Does that help, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
All right, thank you. So our mission is on the top of page 3, right underneath, interestingly enough, the title Mission and Initiatives. It does explain several of the different programs that we have, and I've only highlighted a couple of them. We, unlike when the Conservation Corps was embedded in the Department of Natural Resources, actually spend about 20% of the time that the Corps members are with us in training. Once upon a time, MCC, Minnesota Conservation Corps, was part of the Department of Natural Resources. And then during Governor Ventura's administration, there were cuts to the DNR. The DNR says, we love this program. It's a feeder system for employment. However, we're not youth development people. We're natural resource people. So they cut the program. I had a little bit to do with the bridge funding to help it go from being part of an agency to being a nonprofit. There were a group of people that formed a friends group that came to me as chairman of the division and said, could you help us make a bridge here so that we can keep this program going? It's too good. It has too many good results to just throw in the trash heap. So that was done, and since that time, because of AmeriCorps guidelines, but also because we believe this is important, we give a lot of training. If you go to the next page, you can, on page 4, under 2012 participants, you can see the breakout of the numbers of individuals by age in the various programs that we have. We do have a small program with the folks, the Neighborhood Energy Connection in St. Paul, where energy squads, as they're called, go in and do weatherization in St. Paul homes. We've done 6,000, close to 6,000 homes in the years that we've been doing this. I might be a little high on that, but there are people who pay for the whatever the change is, if it's light bulbs, thermostats, a blanket on their water heater. The idea here is to make these homes more energy efficient and save people energy and reduce our consumption of energy. We also have a program that we started with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which is on this page, called the Apprenticeship Academy. And that program will come through this committee as well. It's been funded in the past by LCCMR funds. 35 college-age folks or recent graduates are placed individually in counties, soil water conservation districts, or WMOs. They have a mentor. They have a customized program for the summer, and that's what they do. So, for example, up in Senator Ingebrigtsen's district, we had a young man who worked with the county near Fergus Falls, and he restored a 40-acre prairie. That was his baby. That was his project. He brought to the county expertise about that. He did some GIS work. They were very pleased with him. And this is a guy who had never sat on a tractor before, but he learned all about how to restore a prairie. We had a young person who was in Washington County that worked with the Soil Water Conservation District. She did a whole bunch of GIS work. These were new skills that a lot of the people in that entity did not have. Well, I could go on to talk about that, but let's talk about what it is that we're after here and what's been recommended in the governor's budget. He's recommended, thank goodness, $455,000 of general fund each year of the biennium in general funds. We had more than that when we left DNR. What do we use those funds for? They're used to leverage money from other sources. If you look at the chart on the bottom of page 5, you can see that the greatest portion of the revenue that we generate each year comes from what we call partner support. That's where our crews go out and do work. That's 60% in the last year. This is possible because those general fund dollars help us go after the other things that you see as part of the chart, all those other segments. And this is an important thing for us. Unfortunately for us, the last biennium, the support from the general fund was reduced as part of the budget cuts. And so at the end of this particular biennial year, we would be down to zero general fund dollars. So we really, really appreciate the governor's support in this. And, I mean, why does he support us? I don't know. I haven't asked him directly, but his staff said he's impressed with the program that we do and the fact that we employ all these young people, give them these opportunities. The other big chunk of money that we find in the governor's budget is the natural resources funds. Those are dollars that accumulate to $490,000 a year. When we left DNR, that was part of the agreement for us to be able to have a book of business, if you would, work for these corps, for these crews that had done work in the DNR previously. These are dollars that come from licenses on snowmobiles, canoes, boats. They're statutorily dedicated to specific activities, so they can't be used for anything else. We sit down with DNR. We talk about what their needs are. They say, well, we want to do this much work in water acquisition, or we want to do this much work on snowmobile trails. And so when you look at pages 7 and 8, you'll see a long list of the various funds and the amount of work that was negotiated for us to do with the amount in some unit, acres, miles, whatever, and the number of hours that we spent actually doing the work in those particular statutorily dedicated areas. So our final comment here, I don't know how much time we have left, but these folks that work in these programs have accumulated an enormous amount of work that's very cost effective. I mean, think about it. All the public land that is the responsibility to be managed by government. We provide a cost-effective workforce to be able to do that. That saves taxpayer dollars. That stretches the dollar. But the other part of the win-win situation is we're able to give all these young people, who everybody says should get outdoors, should be cognizant of natural resources, should get unplugged electronically, it gives them an opportunity to do that and also learn job skills and, in some cases, make a little bit of money. That's a win-win situation for everybody. We're happy to continue to do this. I'm pleased to tell you today that in the audience with me is John Valine, who some of you know as the past executive director of LCCMR. I talked John into being a member of our board after he retired, and he's chairman of our board now. I'll tell you, he's a slave driver. He's my boss. And we also have three of the staff people that are here. Eric Antonson, who is the person who runs all of the programs for youth and also the energy squads and the Conservation Apprentice Academy. He's got a very full plate. He, too, worked his way through the Corps. He served in a couple of different organizations before he took this position. And Connie Lampier and Valerie, who Valerie's so new, I don't even remember her last name. She just came on board in the last month to be involved in our communications, fundraising, and alumni association creation efforts. And we would have Corps members here today, but we don't have some for some of the programs. They haven't been recruited yet. But secondly, our crew leaders are Camp Friendship at Annandale in the first segment of their training. And then next week, the Corps members that are 18 to 25 years of age will show up for the first week of their training. I don't know. There's many other things that we could say. I'm sorry. I usually try before the hearing to get to meet everybody on the committee, and that just hasn't happened. I will try to do that. I know I pestered some of your staff. I'm sorry about that. I did have the chance to meet with some. I bring my little album of photos that kind of show some of the things we've done, but I will visit with each of you. And I just one other thing I would say for the benefit of the two Minneapolis senators in the room. We are so pleased that the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board agreed in their budget deliberations in December that we, the Conservation Corps of Minnesota, should start a program, youth outdoors program, after school and summer, or Saturdays and summer work, starting this next school semester. We hope that grows into a program that's as successful as the one that we've had for 4 years in St. Paul. The goals of the park board there are really interesting. They want to plant 4,500 trees. They've lost through disease, tornadoes. They have a huge canopy, and we can be part of that. We can contribute to that. And also, they are very concerned about aquatic invasives on their lakes, and so we might get involved with some boat inspections or at least educational activities with our Corps members at boat landing. So we're very pleased that that is another stage of another successful program that we could have. I'll shut up, Mr. Chairman.
I was wondering when you were going to do that. Okay. members, in your packets, there's a list of activities that may have gone on in your district. I think with your name is probably on top of it. It might be an old Senate district because this looks like it's my old Senate district, and probably based on what it was before the redistricting. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, for doing that because I messed up. I did not do Senator Westrom's correctly, and I will make sure he gets that. Well, and you're right, it is the old district, and it's caused me heartburn. I can't figure out some of these lines sometimes, but I did my best.
That's what you got Mr. Valine for. He used to be really good. By the way, did you want to say something, John? Sit down. And say your name for the record. And
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Valine. I'm the chair of the board of the Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa. I am tremendously pleased to be in this position because we help these young people and we improve their job skills, and consequently, they get better at finding work. Many of them not only get better at finding work, but they're better people. You can see it in their eyes, and as Len mentioned, the way they stand up a little straighter, they're more proud of who they are, and they go about life as better citizens. And so it's a great pleasure working with this program, and I think the Minneapolis Park Board action to initiate the after-school program there is going to make a lot of difference, and we're really looking forward to it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. For those of you who don't know Mr. Valine, he was the former executive director of what is now the LCCMR and did a great job there, and he had a bad back at one time, I remember. How's your back?
Much better. I've been exercising and dieting, and it helps a lot.
That does it. Okay, good. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to either one of you, as you're talking about the workforce and the assistance that they can help with government lands and property and different things, do you do anything in our state parks, and is there ever a partnership that could be struck? A lot of times we struggle with our state parks and the cost of maintaining them, and in our area we actually have some friends of the state park that try to do some of the work on the beaches and keep things clean, but it strikes me as maybe your program is a happy medium in some cases of jobs that maybe need some supervision, but just good laborers to help get a job done. Any working with the state parks currently, or is that something in the future that could be a cost savings and a win-win situation?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, we do an extensive amount of work in the state parks. The summer youth program for 15 to 18-year-olds, the big chunk of work that they do are in the state parks. They are trained for a week in non-powered tool operation, and then they spend the next 3 weeks working out in the parks. They camp there. They do a variety of things. It could be, I once tore up a trail along Gooseberry Falls State Park, Upper Falls Trail, and then we rebuilt it. These were with high school kids under the supervision of a DNR technician, and I always like to tell the story about most of those DNR guys say, we thought this would take a week, and it only took you 2.5 days. Now what are we going to do with you? Because they're such good workers. But they spend all summer there. There was a girl who testified. This gives me a great example here. There was a girl who testified right in this room in 2006, I think it was. She was from Minneapolis, and she was an African-American girl, and I said, we want you to tell, we would have had some here today, but they couldn't get out of school. We would like you to tell the committee about your experiences. Didn't tell them what to say, but I said, one of the questions you're going to get, and sure enough, it was Senator Vickerman says, so what was the value of this experience? This is what this girl said. She said, well, I've never been camping in my life. My parents don't own a car. Why would we think we're going to go camping? I live in the inner city. The waterfalls I saw were on TV and on calendars. I'd never seen a waterfall, and here I spent all summer along the North Shore in state parks. I saw all kinds of them. In my neighborhood, you didn't go outside at night without streetlights. And there I discovered no streetlights, but also a night sky. Unbelievable. And she said, but the most important thing for me as a 17-year-old African-American girl who went to Patrick Henry High School was I always wondered how I would be perceived outside my school and my neighborhood. And I found out I'm okay.
Nice. Nice. Can we try to get you some money back in 2005? was...
You know me. I'm always looking for money, Mr. Chair. Yes. Thank you for your support in the past.
So this, so in the budget book, then, we're going back to the level of funding from 2 years ago? Is that what it is? Or?
No, actually, more than 2 years ago. We would be close to what we had when we became a nonprofit in 2003. But we've been able to expand some of our other revenue sources, but we're finding that we need those additional dollars to make those leverages, and that's why this is really crucial, this general fund money.
Is there any private money?
We go to grants, and we also solicit individual contributors. Foundation world is really tough. It's, I don't know, we do sometimes 2-3 grants a month, and we get responses like, we're reconsidering our strategic plan. We're reevaluating who we are going to contribute to. If anybody's got familiarity with nonprofit things, they know that's the usual conversation. So we make an effort, and it's just really hard.
Any of the natural resource money or Bowser money, or is any of it legacy money?
Yes. We don't get the money directly, but we do a tremendous amount of work with Parks and Trails, who receives the legacy dollars. And then in the bill, there's been language that says, when you receive those dollars, give consideration to using the Conservation Corps. And that's really helped. We had $500,000 of legacy money that went to Bowser grant programs. We then worked with the grantees. We had $1.5 million. We didn't get it. DNR Parks and Trails got $1.5 million for legacy dollars of the many millions that they get. And then we, in turn, were given the work to do that trail work. I was struck by the Tourism Bureau's testimony here about, what is it, $11 billion or whatever that number is that they get. And if you look at their materials, you'll find out that one of the biggest attractions to Minnesota is the trail system. And we do a tremendous amount of work on trails. That's a big part of what we do, and these young people are good at it. So, you know, that really helps, too. And so I'm not saying that this is the only money that we receive. We get it indirectly in other places, and that helps us give these opportunities to young people. I'll just give you one last statistic, which I forgot to mention. In 2012, 515 youth and young adults were enrolled in our program. They completed over 400,000 hours of work, and they led 6,000 volunteers in endeavors in parks, in other areas. So we not only do the work ourselves, but we also get other people that are in these other endeavors. We give them direction and organization when there is a volunteer day.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator, for that report. I know it's always challenging in my other life. I always had to balance the prisoner, and I shouldn't compare this to the same, but the prisoner work with the private sector, like you have to do. I mean, you have to make sure you don't take away that private work that is so needed out there with these volunteers. But I've met with you several times. I appreciate the work you do, and I'm so glad that you're able to get the kids from the inner city out to better Minnesota and get them out there to take a look. So, and I'm not saying that just because my city council is sitting behind you either.
We, Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, we appreciate the efforts that you've made in the past to support us, and I understand the parameters that you were dealing with. We would like to be able to work with more cities through the community the Community Partners Program in the Lasard-Sams portion of the Legacy area. We don't have the staff. It would be me if we had one, to go out and actually talk to every community about the things that we could do. But if you folks, the ambassadors for those programs, would talk to your city people and say, hey, we know of a group that could do some of this work for you, maybe, contact us, and we'd be happy to sit down and visit about that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good job. Keep up the good work. Anything else, anybody? Okay. Then, starting at Monday's the next meeting, we have any bills? Mm-hmm. Okay. We could possibly have Senate File 1 here on Monday if it's ready. Otherwise, it looks like we... That's the... PC, the what? Oh, no, the Senate File 1. The healthcare exchange.
Sure.
That has to come through here also. Because there's Commerce Department issues in the bill. So, anyway, okay. All right, meeting adjourned. I'm here.